Welcome to Open Minds, a Freedom of Thought podcast series, interviewing the people who bring courage and independent thought to the challenges of today.
Welcome, everyone, to the Freedom of Thought podcast. I'm delighted to have with me Ashley Keller, who is a partner and co-founder of the law firm Keller Postman, one of the most innovative plaintiffs mass action firms in the country today. Ashley helped build the litigation funding industry, and he's involved with some very important antitrust litigation on the plaintiff side, representing the state of Texas and going against Google. Ashley identifies as a conservative plaintiff's lawyer, and we're here to explore the paradox or not in that formulation. So, Ashley, welcome.
Thank you, Judge. It's not an oxymoron.
Well, let's talk about that. So, I guess begin at the beginning. Educational background, how you came to have the thoughts you had, whether you thought the same way when you were in college and law school.
Sure. So I went to Harvard for undergrad. I started there as, I'd say, a moderate Republican with some libertarian leanings, and I left a fire-breathing conservative. There's nothing like being around a bunch of liberals to make you more conservative, and that stuck. I worked at a hedge fund after college called Clipper Capital in Boston, which sort of introduced me to finance and refined my thinking about going into a career purely in law and made me think that I wanted to do something with a business orientation. I then went to the University of Chicago for law and business school, was all set to go to another hedge fund in Chicago when I got an opportunity to clerk for Judge Posner on the Seventh Circuit and then an opportunity to clerk here in DC for Justice Kennedy. So I did that. Went to Bartlett Beck, which is a litigation boutique, after clerking in Chicago. After a couple of years working there, it's a terrific law firm, but mostly defense side, mostly traditional high-stakes disputes that you would expect to see at any sort of white shoe firm. The business itch needed to be scratched again, and so I went to another hedge fund in Chicago, spent some time there, and then started the litigation finance business that you referenced, Gershon Keller Capital. Eventually sold that business to another litigation financier, Burford, which is a publicly listed company trading on the AIM in London. And from there, I started Keller Postman, which is the plaintiff side litigation firm that I've been at ever since.
So you started, your early experiences include the University of Chicago, clerking for Richard Posner, one of the giants of the law and economics movement, and business school, all of which might tend to suggest a conventional pro-business orientation. Was that a fair summary of where you were then? And if not, how do you evolve from that?
Yeah, so I don't think I've ever been pro-business or anti-business, and I still don't think I am. Milton Friedman always talked about the plaintiff's bar as the free market solution to regulating businesses as opposed to having a big government bureaucracy, and I still subscribe to those views. Businesses provide important products and services to their customers, all of us, and I'm glad that they do. They also misbehave all the time. And when they do so, they should be punished just like everybody else. And there should be economic consequences through the civil justice system when they commit torts. And so I don't view there being any inconsistency between my sort of conservative principles, my free market bona fides, and the fact that I sue big companies for a living.
More generally, you identify as a member of the conservative legal movement. Let's use that for
proudly
shorthand.
So,
what does that mean to you? And can you break that down into areas where you think the conventional conservative view is spot on, and any areas where you might differ?
Yeah, sure. I'll abstract from your question a little bit. I'll start by saying, here's what I think of as a conservative, and this is both an over and under inclusive definition, but given time constraints, I won't flesh it out entirely. I think that the purpose of government is to protect our God-given natural rights. That's not some innovative view. It's very Lockean sort of enlightenment. And in a previous era, I don't think that would have necessarily been enough to define me as a conservative. I think lots of people we today think of as liberals might have subscribed to that view. But today, I actually think it's a pretty good approximation of what it means to be a conservative. When I think about the conservative legal movement, some of the themes that I buy into that I, again, don't think are all that innovative are formalism, respect for history and tradition, textualism, rules exist, the rule of law is a law of rules, the sort of Scalia principle. And so in a lot of ways, the definition is not what I think is interesting. It's where, and I say this very respectfully to my conservative friends, I'm willing to take our principles to their logical conclusions. And I think some in the conservative legal movement don't always do that.
In what way?
In lots of different ways. And so, when the Chamber of Commerce comes a knocking with an amicus brief, I think there are too many who reflexively are remembering the Reagan era, and businesses were always right back then, so they must be right today. But when you actually look at the things that conservatives purport to look at, the original public meaning of the Constitution, the text of a statute, the chamber is an organization that exists to protect its own, and that's completely fine. They have a First Amendment right to associate and sort of express particular viewpoints, but we in the conservative legal movement shouldn't just reflexively buy it. We should bring a sober-minded and independent analysis to the question presented and see if they're on the right side of the issue. They often are not.
I was lucky to be present when you engaged in the Rosenkrantz debate a couple of years ago on whether the government or private actors were a greater threat to individual freedom. This is a Freedom of Thought podcast, so could you summarize your views on that? You took the position, again, maybe unconventional in conservative thinking, that private actors are a greater threat to individual liberty than the government. That might strike many in this audience as surprising. So,
yeah. And this goes back to that sort of situational awareness. I certainly am not taking the view and didn't take the view in the debate that the government isn't a threat to individual liberty. It is. And in previous generations, certainly in the 80s and the rise of the Reagan sort of conservative movement, government was a much bigger threat than I think private actors or private businesses. But I don't think that's true today. And I think there's a little bit of a generational divide on this question, again, where sort of people who came of age as conservatives when Reagan was president or in the years immediately preceding that, they just have this instinct that government can do no right. We need it to be smaller. There need to be fewer taxes. You know, Republicans exist to, cut taxes, is I think a Grover Norquist kind of line, and it has to be smaller. We need to starve the beast. All of those instincts were right back then, but they have ossified our thinking and sort of blinded us to what I think a younger generation is seeing every day, where corporations are working in concert and are pursuing an agenda that is antithetical to what conservatives and in, a previous era, classical liberals believe. And we see it all the time with the woke sort of policies that corporations are engaging in, the, I think, morally bankrupt and legally dubious critical race training that's going on that guys like Chris Rufo are uncovering. These, I think, are the more pernicious threats to our freedoms today. That's not to say that we should turn a blind eye to government. Government always needs to be kept in its lane, and we need to keep a watchful eye on them. But as I noted in the debate, a big part of the success of keeping government more or less at bay has been the Federalist Society. We've got great Article III judges like yourself who are there to safeguard our cherished liberties and I think to push back on government overreach. And so we have people who are already in positions of influence and power through the sinews of government abilities and Article III to protect us against executive overreach. Still a problem, still something that needs to be on our radar, but corporations are running amok.
The conventional view would say government, by definition, has an absolute monopoly power on the coercive use of force, and government power is coercive. In contrast, you know, Princeton University may behave in many crazy ways, and Coca-Cola may behave in many crazy ways, but Princeton has to compete with Harvard and Yale and all the other universities, and Coke has to compete with Pepsi, so there's a market dynamic that will necessarily temper excess in the private sector that just doesn't operate in government. What would you say to that?
Yeah, so the first part's totally right. The government has a monopoly on the legitimate use of coercive force, except in the case of self-defense, but we'll put that to one side. On the second part, is the market really working out all that well? I think anybody with eyes and ears can see that it's not working the way your microeconomics textbook would teach you that it is. Princeton doesn't have to compete with Harvard because they're both equally on the lunatic fringe. And Pepsi doesn't have to compete with Coke because they're both trying to outcompete each other and how crazy far to the left they're willing to go. All of these corporations have been captured by an elite group of people whose viewpoints do not reflect those of the entire country or even the majority of the country. And whether it's because of virtue signaling or they were all educated at those same elite schools like the two that you just mentioned and that, you know, you and I both went to, or lots of other different factors. I don't have to diagnose them all to say there's not that competition for balance. There's not companies out there advertising like, hey, we're normal. We don't discriminate on the basis of race. We're not going to have racial quotas. We're not going to give you re-education camp training for why you should apologize for your whiteness, come work here. They all seem to be trying to outcompete each other in how far to the left they're going to run. So the market forces that normally would operate in your textbooks are failing because corporations are not just pursuing the bottom line and how to maximize their profits, they're pursuing a concerted agenda.
And why wouldn't you think of that as corporations competing to appear attractive and attract business from a younger generation that they perceive to be more woke?
Well, because there's just no evidence that that's the reason the companies are doing it. I heard this before from John Allison, who I shared the debate stage with. The companies don't really believe in this woke stuff, but they feel like they have to do it to maximize their profits. Where's the analysis showing that it actually maximizes their profit? Where's the analysis showing that where you alienate two-thirds of your customer base because of your woke viewpoints, that'll actually work out in the long haul because of all the young people that you're bringing over to your brand? Where's the evidence that all the young people are thrilled at these woke policies? You don't have any sort of rigorous analysis. McKinsey didn't come in and say, here's the report showing that if you engage in these behaviors, you're going to do better for your shareholders. I think it's pretty obvious that it's something else going on that's animating and motivating these executives to engage in these policies.
So the another spin on the conventional view, borrowing from the mission statement of this great organization, is that the state exists to preserve individual freedom. How do you think that's right, and how would you qualify it, or how would you apply it in the kinds of circumstances we have where you perceive a lot of threats from private actors?
Yeah, I do think that it's right, as I told you before. I think the purpose of government is to protect our God-given rights. And so, you know, our freedoms are sort of synonymous with our rights, our life, our liberty, and our property. So that is absolutely the function of government. And a big part of protecting freedom is the rule of law. These companies are behaving lawlessly. Some of the behavior that I've described is merely repugnant and inconsistent with a culture that values some of the things that I think are important for lowercase r republicanism. But a lot of what these corporations are doing is flat out illegal. Goldman Sachs announced that they weren't going to take companies public if they didn't have a certain number of board members who checked characteristics, immutable characteristics or behavioral characteristics. That's discrimination on the basis of immutable characteristics. We have civil rights laws that prevent that. I think it is completely compatible with a government that exists to protect freedom to vigorously enforce our laws against that behavior. And if we want our laws to change to allow what we used to call 10 minutes ago, invidious discrimination, the democratic process should work its way and the law should be repealed. We shouldn't have executives, because of their political valence, turning a blind eye to flagrant disregard for laws that were previously regarded as some of the most important pieces of legislation enacted in American history.
Let's talk about a couple of more specific issues. So Mallory, it's a case pending at the Supreme Court, which you argued in the fall on personal jurisdiction as applied to general jurisdiction, as applied to corporations. I've seen it described more than one place as a sleeper case, one that might not have been on the front pages at the beginning of the term, but might have a lot of potential to have some broad-ranging impacts, particularly if you win. So why don't you tell us a little about what Mallory is and how it ties into your broader views of corporate accountability and such.
Sure. I don't know if it's asleep or awake or what the policy ramifications are. Of course, I don't care about the policy ramifications. As a matter of first principle, I care about getting the interpretation of the Constitution right. So back in the 1800s, when corporations were first being formed, the view was they're pure creatures of the state that commissioned them or allowed them to be incorporated. So they couldn't operate outside of the territory of the sovereign state where they were incorporated, other than as a matter of grace. And so initially, states would allow foreign corporations to operate within their borders, but the mischief that was created, remember, we're in a Penoyer versus Neff world where concepts of personal jurisdiction and judicial power in personam were based principally on territory, a territorial presence. What happened was the corporation's agents would commit torts or breach contracts, and when the aggrieved plaintiff would attempt to hail them into the courts of that state, the state courts would say, we don't have personal jurisdiction because you didn't serve the principal of the company with process. The principal shareholder would obviously remain in the state where the company was incorporated. And so to address that, long before the 14th Amendment was ratified in 1868, these consent by registration statutes became commonplace. And so what these statutes essentially said is, if you want the privilege of doing business in our state, which we don't have to grant you because you're a foreign corporation, you will consent to have an agent be present to accept service of process. And that service of process will be as valid as if it had been served on the principal. And the states varied, as you would expect, with sort of laboratory of democracy principles in terms of what type of agency relationship had to be created. Several states mirrored what we would now call specific jurisdiction, but in 1868 there was no such thing as specific jurisdiction, and they said the agent has to accept service of process for any claims arising out of the corporate agent's activity in the state. Other states said, You've got to consent to what we would now call general jurisdiction for our residents, for residents of our state, but you only have to consent to what, again, we would now call specific jurisdiction for other types of torts. And then many states went as far as Pennsylvania did in the statute that was before the court in the fall in Mallory, and they said, you've just got to consent to general jurisdiction. For any suit under the sun, all writs, all claims, all causes of action that can be brought against your company, your agent has to agree to accept service of that type of process as if it were served on the principal. By my count, there were 18 states in the union that had that type of statute for at least some companies. So there were only 35 states in the union in 1868, so that's more than half. One more than half of the country. And then by 1900, if you believe in liquidation as a way to settle the meaning of an ambiguous constitutional provision and you're willing to go out a couple of years, by 1900, another 14 states were added to the list. So well over half the country by the turn of the century had these sort of general jurisdiction statutes.
So you don't want to talk about policy, but let's just do that.
Sure.
For a minute. So to be clear, what we're talking about is a railroad which has tracks, let's just assume, in all over the country. And this statute requires the railroad to submit to jurisdiction in Pennsylvania on cases having nothing to do with Pennsylvania, right? The corporate headquarters is somewhere else. The employees are somewhere else. The accident happened somewhere else. And any suit involving anything, any part of the corporation can be brought in Pennsylvania just because they do some business in Pennsylvania. What sense does that make?
Well, I'll talk about policy in a minute, so I won't dodge your question. But I would quibble with the word require. It doesn't require Norfolk Southern or any other company to do that. It says you have a choice. If you want the privilege of doing business in Pennsylvania, you have to consent to exactly what you just described. They don't have to do business in Pennsylvania. Companies, as we see, going back to our previous conversation, they are quite capable of making choices about where they want to do business. And oftentimes it's in reaction to conservative policies at the state level that they're saying, we're going to take our stuff and leave this area. And that's fine. I have no problem with companies making that choice. But when the shoe is on the other foot, it's also them making a choice. And so if Norfolk Southern chooses to stay in Pennsylvania, that's not requiring them to consent to jurisdiction. It's giving them a difficult but a real choice, and they made that choice. And so, yes, they would have to be subject to any suit under the sun. What sense does that make? I think it makes fair sense to say this is the quid pro quo, and we're going to hold you to our bargain. You knew what you were getting into ex ante, and the world knew, other plaintiffs knew what the repercussions of that were. And so we've decided to open our courthouse doors to more people than would traditionally be able to come in under specific jurisdiction rules, but, you know, consent does that.
Seems like the kind of bargain no one would think is constitutional as applied to what you call a flesh and blood human. California couldn't say to out-of-staters, if you choose to come into our border, you must forfeit your First Amendment rights. So why is this different? Is it just corporations are made up and people are real idea, or is there more to it?
Well, let's even take your example. California couldn't make the First Amendment quid pro quo that you just suggested, but California absolutely could say, if we find you here in California, we can tag you with any process under the sun, and we don't have to guess about that. The Burnham case was California. Mr. Burnham was traveling from New Jersey to California, and he got tagged there for a divorce suit having no connection to California. And it was a unanimous Supreme Court, 9 justices. The reasoning was splintered, but everybody said that was A-OK. I do think that the Supreme Court has correctly said the Privileges and Immunities Clause only applies to real people, not to corporations. So restricting someone's right to travel to California in exchange for giving up First Amendment rights, I do think that that would be an unconstitutional burden on people's right to go from one state to another. And it could potentially be an unconstitutional condition on the exercise of First Amendment rights. But the answer to your question, as a formalist and, you know, proud member of the conservative legal movement, is because the original public meaning of the Due Process Clause lets Pennsylvania do this, but it doesn't let California do that.
Part of your account in Mallory, not all of it, but part of it is that corporations are different. And you run the argument you run. Mallory's about personal jurisdiction, but to what extent would you generalize that principle to restrict or view corporations as having fewer constitutional rights than others? First Amendment, let's say, you know, Citizens United is a hot button issue. You come down on the side of it's a corporation and therefore it can be regulated just as a condition of coming into existence or doing business?
So I definitely think corporations have fewer rights than real people. They're legal fictions. Their existence is due to filing a piece of paper, usually in Delaware's Secretary of State's office. So I do think that that makes them different than regular people, and I do think lots of constitutional protections were made only for regular people and not corporate types. The Privileges and Immunities Clause is just one example that we talked about. It talks about citizens, and I don't think corporations are citizens as an original matter. That having been said, on the First Amendment question, I think it's difficult because there are associational rights in play, and let's take Citizens United as the example, since that's what you asked about. If seven people get together and they want to express a particular political viewpoint, which is, of course, core protected First Amendment speech, does it matter that they banded together through something that has an LLC structure as opposed to just being, you know, Tom, Dick, and Harry? I don't think that that really should matter for First Amendment purposes. I'm a formalist, but I'm not that formalist. Once you extract out from that, though, and you say, you know, does a Fortune 500 company with 60 million shareholders who don't have the same political views, did not band together to form political viewpoints, basically banded together because they wanted to make a profit and get certain dividend payments associated with their shares, does First Amendment protections extend to that company using those shareholder dollars to spend on a particular political view that many of those shareholders might find repugnant? I'm not sure that the First Amendment extends in that context. I'd want to review it more, but I'm skeptical. I'm dubious.
What about, so if the relatively easy cases on the opposite side of the spectrum are Hobby Lobby, 303 Creative, the small family business,
closely held
with strong religious interests or speech purpose among the principals, that's likely to be protected. Coca-Cola, General Motors, probably not. What about the large corporate conglomerate that is in the business of speech? Twitter, Facebook. There's been a lot of litigation about whether companies like that do or don't have First Amendment rights. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, obviously a hot topic, you know, sub judice at the court as well. A key premise that I'm not sure I accept is that they're in the business of speaking themselves as opposed to facilitating others' speech, and sort of their editorializing, I think, is a very hot issue. I could dodge your question by saying, you know, a lot of this could be regulated at the state level because the First Amendment is only a prohibition on Congress, but the truth is applying First Amendment principles in that context is the hardest thing right now vis-a-vis corporations. I don't have a fully formed view on that. Again, like a good originalist, I'm going to want to look at a lot more history than I've reviewed before I come up with an answer. But my instinct is that they wouldn't get First Amendment protections. But That's only an instinct at this point.
The other area I wanted to drill down a little bit with you on is antitrust, partly because you're actively involved and partly because that may be an area where there was a very conventional orthodox conservative view that might be coming under some question. So for people my age, and you're a little bit younger than I am, but not a lot, the Bible of antitrust was, of course, Bork's book, Antitrust Paradox, and made the point that consumer welfare should be the lodestar of antitrust law, and that makes the world better.
Yeah.
So was that part of your formative experience? Did you ever believe that? Do you still believe that? And how do you reconcile whatever views you have with your robust plaintiff side practice?
Yeah, so it definitely was part of what I read and thoroughly enjoyed and internalized. So Antitrust Paradox is a big part of the reason I went to law school. And I take a backseat to no one in my love for the late, great Bob Bork. I don't think there's anything missing in his analysis. What I think we need to realize coming back to an old theme is that he was responding at a particular moment in time and observing that a lot of the antitrust doctrine that had developed in a sort of common law fashion from the Supreme Court was doing more harm than good. And I think he correctly described a lot of those negative repercussions. But the negative repercussions that he described were based on empirical observations that I don't think hold true. And, you know, the antitrust paradox, right, is you invite a corporation to compete and then you punish that corporation when they successfully compete. The sort of quasi-paradox today is the profit motive was supposed to underlie everything and drive corporations to deliver better goods and services to consumers. And they have competed and made so many profits that they have become behemoths. And, you know, the number of small and medium-sized businesses has gone dramatically down. There's a lot more concentration of market power. And then for lots of reasons that are not purely based on market economics, they're cultural, they're educational, topics that we don't have time to fully delve into here. I don't think that these large corporations are now driven purely by profit. And so all of the efficiency gains that Bork described that come from when corporations just focus on the bottom line and worry about their competitors coming and eating their lunch and stealing their customers, that's not something that we're seeing now when corporations are banding together to engage in some of the woke misbehavior that we were talking about before. And so when you test the assumption, are corporations only operating to maximize profits, and you call it into question, all sorts of observations that Bork accurately made at the time that the antitrust paradox was penned don't hold anymore. And so our antitrust doctrine needs to be flexible enough to account for those changed circumstances and those changed forms of corporate misbehavior.
Is it a fair inference of what you just said, that the emergence of the ESG movement strengthens the case for more robust antitrust enforcement, because you can no longer trust the board to maximize social welfare?
Absolutely. And you have these massive mutual funds that control huge chunks of the number of voting shares at S&P 500 companies. They sold consumers on getting low-fee access to the S&P 500 returns, and, you know, we're just going to be this conduit for you to have a diversified portfolio. And they've all of a sudden decided together, right? It's not just State Street or BlackRock or whomever acting alone. Vanguard, they're all pushing this ESG agenda, and they own huge chunks of the S&P 500. And so they're pushing a nonprofit maximizing perspective, and they're doing it in concert. I think that's a potentially huge antitrust problem. And to go back to an earlier question you asked, you know, could this possibly, or John Allison asked, could this possibly really just be profit maximizing? I always laugh when I hear people suggest that the ESG policies that companies are implementing are really designed to maximize profit. Because if ESG was really profit maximizing, would you broadcast to all of your competitors what you're doing? Of course not. You'd keep it a secret. You'd say, we've got this special sauce to make our company more profitable. Let's not tell anybody. They virtue signal to everybody. So they're giving up the secret to better profits? That's nonsense. They're doing it for other reasons.
Let's see, what else? Your firm has been very involved in developing the mass arbitration idea. You want to talk about that for a little bit?
Yeah, and I'm gonna give credit where it's due. My firm has a lot of great professionals who are involved in this strategy, but the principal among them is Warren Postman, my partner, who really innovated and came up with this idea. And the basic thrust of it is, we went through a long period of time where the Supreme Court has enforced to the letter the Federal Arbitration Act, which essentially says that arbitration contracts have to be put on the same footing as any other contract. And so corporations took advantage of that to put a lot of traditional class actions into arbitration. So wage and hour claims, consumer protection claims, the sorts of things that would have often been brought under Rule 23 or state law equivalents were pushed into arbitration. And then as the plaintiff's bar pushed back and tried to say these agreements are unconscionable or you can't waive class actions through cases like Concepcion, the Supreme Court said, no, you're still going to arbitrate. And as part of selling the Supreme Court on the virtues of arbitration, these companies, the chamber, led the charge on this. They said, don't worry, Supreme Court, arbitration's great for the consumer. It's great for the little guy and little gal. We'll pay all the fees. We'll ensure that plaintiffs can, efficiently get access to justice and have thousands of claims adjudicated as opposed to just a couple of bellwether trials. So arbitration's great. They're actually going to get a better deal. It's superior to litigation for these sorts of claims. So we said, okay, we'll take you at your word. We will sign up 1,000, 10,000, 100,000 aggrieved consumers since we can't bring a class, and we'll go arbitrate with you and we'll see where the chips fall. And universally, all of these companies cry foul. They say that we're extorting them based on the arbitration fees that they agreed by contract to pay. That our cases don't have any merit, never mind that in some of the arbitrations that actually went, we had 100% win rate. And so we've turned the tables on them and said, if you want to eliminate class actions, which are a very efficient way to resolve a lot of plaintiffs' claims, and have arbitration, we'll have arbitration. And if you don't like it, you wrote the contract.
So. How do you manage 100,000 cases at once?
Yeah, so.
And what do you say to the old nugget that the argument that was made against traditional B3 class actions that, it doesn't make economic sense to spend $100 to resolve a 50 cent underlying dispute?
Yeah, right. The old Posner line that like only a lunatic or whatever sues for $20 or something to that effect. So first of all, we don't typically bring $20 claims or 50 cent claims. We're still constrained by normal economics and people's sanity. So we can't bring suits even if a company has done something affirmatively wrong if the stakes aren't high enough. But if it's a $500 claim or a $1,000 claim or a couple $1,000 claim, it is economical for us to pursue that. And part of the reason we can efficiently manage 50, 100,000 clients at the same time is, but for the arbitration clause, these would have been class actions. So everybody is essentially harmed in exactly the same way. It's the same statutory violation or it's the same sort of consumer protection violation. The misbehavior is just applied 100,000 times. And so, in those contexts where it should be a class but for the arbitration clause, it is economically feasible for us and administrable for us to pursue lots of claims at the same time.
What about the argument, somewhat related, but another argument made against class actions, which is that the companies, the defendants can be coerced into settling, whether it's one giant B3 class or a million of these small arbitrations, they're coerced into settling not because the claims have likelihood of success, but just because the aggregate exposure is so crushing, they just can't roll the dice.
Yeah, so that argument really never resonated with me in this context or in the class context. So in this context, if they're complaining about transaction costs, they have only themselves to blame. They knew exactly what the transaction costs were when they wrote this into their contract and forced consumers away from class action. So cry me a river that plaintiffs are actually taking them up on the bargain that they made plaintiffs strike. I have no sympathy for that argument. And in the class context, why can't you roll the dice? If you think that the class is bogus, even though it is certifiable as a class, let the class get certified and win on the merits. Prove that you deserve to prevail in a civil justice system that I hope we all believe in. And when you win on the merits, you'll pay zero. And if you think there's a 5% chance you're going to lose on the merits, then in a reasonable settlement discussion, you should pay 5% of the total value of that claim. And if you think there's a 30% chance you're going to lose on the merits, you should pay up to 30. But the idea that because we've aggregated all of these people together, corporations have no choice but to settle, I think that's just chamber talking points.
Anything else you want to before this FedSoc audience?
I've probably put way too much on the table already, so I'll call it quits there with my thanks.
Ashley Keller, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Judge.
Thank you for listening to Open Minds, a Freedom of Thought podcast series interviewing the people who bring courage and independent thought to the challenges of today. To learn more, visit freedomofthought.fedsoc.org.